My word, it actually alleges to be recording. So hopefully we'll have to find it. This is where I get to embarrass myself in public. And the good news about doing my own recordings is I can edit them before I put them online. Actually, it's very funny that you should have raised this when you did, because yesterday I was reviewing a recording of the talk I gave in France before I provided it to a client. And it was probably an okay talk, but it was definitely not in the academic talk style, because it was as much of a sales pitch as anything. So I seem to be doing a lot with audio this week. I don't know. All right. I want to do two of three things today, because I'm not going to actually make it to the third. And the first is administrivia. So I will not be here Monday and Tuesday of next week. The unspeakable genius of the Department of Homeland Security is that they scheduled a conference for people who are working on high assurance systems on the Jewish high holidays. Given the percentage of people engaged in this activity who are probably going to be in synagogue on those days, this was not exceptionally bright of them. As it turns out, I don't really practice, so I'm going to go and explain this to them. Probably in pointed terms. I often use pointed terms with the people who head up this particular activity. And I expect to come back Wednesday thoroughly depressed, because the history here is that the National Security Agency used to understand that you can't do good crypto without a secure system to run it on. The people who knew how to build secure systems have slowly trickled out of the agency, leaving a very, very good crypto group behind. And there's still a few people who are trying to figure out how to do this, but they're basically subcritical on manpower. And this process has occurred recursively until even their management actually doesn't understand the issue entirely. And so actually trying to get them to talk to people who are trying to really solve this problem becomes increasingly frustrating over time. And in fairness, it's a hard problem, and there are good reasons, I think, why people at the agency lost faith in that process. It's very difficult. There were a series of systems that were built in the late 80s that didn't work out too well, partly because they were really hard to build and partly because the requirements were not really well understood. And we understood the requirements from the standpoint of security, but getting security and usability and practicality to all play together nicely in the same document is a really tricky thing. And so there were several companies who actually succeeded in meeting those requirements and ended up having succeeded building systems that were completely unusable unless you were in like one extreme dim dark corner of the spook world. And the problem with those systems came in two places. One is that if you weren't in one of those corners of the world, the usability constraints were such that you weren't going to buy them. That meant they weren't mass market. That meant they couldn't be manufactured cost effectively, because you don't manufacture things cost effectively for 100 people. You do one-off custom building for them, and in software that's expensive. But the other issue, and this has nothing to do with technology, but it happened about the same time, and it just cratered the whole game. There was a very brief window of time when the technology group at NSA said, this kind of technology, it's really critical, it's really important, we don't want it to get into the wrong hands, we should put export controls on this stuff. Okay? And they managed to get into law that systems that implement what are called mandatory access controls, for a long time, were on what's called a munitions control list. Right? This is the same list that stops you from shipping serious automatic weapons, crew-served automatic weapons, nuclear devices, things like that. It's that list, right? So the stuff that I do was on that list for a long time. The technology group figured out after only a very small number of months that if this policy succeeded, the consequence would be that nobody would actually build these systems. Unfortunately, by the time they realized this, a group had been formed at NSA to administer this policy. And as we all know, administrations, like other biological organisms, exist mainly to serve themselves and to grow over time. So once you get an administration in gear, you need a very high level bit of policy maneuvering to kill it. And this state persisted for almost 20 years until a First Amendment case, which was brought by the author of Pretty Good Privacy, Phil Zimmerman. So Phil basically printed the RSA algorithm, I think it was, on a t-shirt, because there was some funniness in the courts about whether software was considered speech, and that had not really been tested in the courts. And there were 50 different exhibits brought into the courtroom, right? 49 of which were very clearly things that were protected as First Amendment free speech. Right? The RSA algorithm printed on a t-shirt, the RSA algorithm printed on paper, right? Various things like this. The last of which was the RSA algorithm stored on a computer. Right? And the point to the judge was, sorry, you don't get to say that these other 49 forms are protected speech and then exempt this one. It just doesn't work. Okay? And a whole bunch of people testified that it is not the case that writing software is a purely mechanical activity. It is expressive in the sense that speech is expressive in our constitutional system. To make a long story longer, the problem with this case, from the perspective, not from the perspective of the NSA, because by that point they were out of this. This had become, you know, sort of a larger issue in the Department of Defense. The problem with this case from the Department of Defense, by this time, almost 20 years later, was not that secure systems were going to get released into the world, because as far as they could tell, nobody actually knew how to build those. And there's more to that story. The problem with this case was that it threatened to move the entire munitions list out of the set of things you could lawfully control. Right. So they said, this is a problem. Let's move control of the software issue over to the Commerce Department. Okay. Whereupon the Commerce Department started writing export control rules. And as it happens, I had a hand in writing those export control rules in circa 2000. And then went to the court and said, look, the law doesn't say this anymore. The whole issue is moot. Let's all go home. Okay? And I don't actually remember what happened to the court case. I think actually the first round was mooted, but then there was some further things that happened in the court case. And the long and short of it now is that you actually now can export encryption software from the US. Although the current administration is once again trying to change this. What happened in Commerce was that they then started trying to write regulations that would sort of straddle a middle ground enough to keep the diehard old guard happy, but also enough to start moving the ball towards more disclosure. And the position they initially took, which was a very, very curious position, was if your implementation was open source, which really they meant source available, although that's not the way the law came out, or if your implementation was shipped as a shrink-wrapped software item that could be purchased on a store shelf, note that in its original form, this did not include things that were web purchasable, then the only thing that you needed in order to export an encryption item was you needed to basically send them a note saying, here's where it's going to be exported from, here's the website it's going to be accessible from. And if it was commodity available, you could then make it available on a website. Okay, but the only way in the original law that it could be available strictly on a website is if it was open source. And the law actually required that you notify them every time you updated and republished this stuff. The result was that several projects put the head of the Commerce Department on their CVS commit mailing list to guarantee that they would be notified every time the software changed that there was now a re-export of the software. That satisfied the letter of the law, okay? And the law was tricky. There was one qualifier, which, and I believe the qualifier still remains in the law, and I personally don't have a problem with it, which is you can't export this stuff to what were then known as the T7 countries, the terrorist seven countries. Now, I don't want to get into the politics of whether the T7 countries are in fact terrorist countries. There's certainly some people who at various times were in those countries that I really don't want to encourage to have strong encryption. But this was actually a completely lame duck restriction, because once it got to Europe, if it was open, you had no control over what happened, right? You know, if you put it on an... So furthermore, the law said you can't explicitly export it to the T7 countries. If you put it on an FTP site, you've got to put on like a big README that says this is not for export to the T7 countries. The question then became, but am I obligated to implement a web filter to actually keep those people out? The answer was no. Right? They understood that once the stuff was loose in the world, it was loose. And they just sort of wanted you to sort of play nicely, which is not unreasonable. The argument there is, look, having the software is a relatively small part of the problem. The know-how to integrate it is the bigger issue, and the know-how to integrate it is a rare and precious resource, and that's the piece that we really sort of don't want to... These guys are going to figure it out, but you don't want to accelerate the process. A lot of this sort of security amounts to fighting holding actions against the inevitable to buy time. And as technologists, we tend to say, look, if somebody's going to figure it out in the next year or two, forget it. The battle's over. Let's move on, because there's the advantage to just making this stuff accessible. Now we can integrate it into the products. We can do this, we can do that, we can do the other. But if we have to worry about slowing down for these other parties, then those benefits become much harder to implement, because it's hard to do both at the same time. And there had always been an exemption for banking applications, right? So this whole thing was kind of weird. I had a talk with the guy who was then head of the Commerce Department in the course of drafting the legislation, and I said, you know, this position is ridiculous, okay? And it got progressively edited, so somebody would come and say, look, you're allowing all these cases, what about this case, okay? And there were some small errors in the way the law had been drafted that got fixed, and then a few new things got added. Pretty soon this stuff was just exportable. Well, people thought, hey, the Commerce Department was stupid, right, and we're going to move the ball one step at a time until the law becomes reasonable. No, no, no. The Commerce Department wasn't stupid. They understood going in that this position that said the only people who could export encryption was the open source people was politically untenable. And the reason they chose it was they knew that it was the best way to get a high-paid Microsoft lobbyist to help them fix the law to the right thing. Okay? So don't, you know, if you ever have occasion to deal with people in government, don't imagine that they're naive about the process of administration. Many of them are, just as many of us are, okay? But some of them are actually very sophisticated about it. And they will set up, in this case, a straw man position that they can navigate through the system, understanding that sometimes process takes time, and if you set up the straw man correctly, you can rely on the process to take it apart. Right? And after it's taken apart, you end up in the position you really want it, which may be a position that makes perfect sense, but it may be a position that you can't navigate past lawmakers today. Right? It's a really interesting process to watch. None of which has anything to do with our course net. There was something there I was going to come back to. Mandatory access controls. Okay, so for those who don't know, there's actually a really bad problem in the literature. There's a set of terms that are that were poorly framed when they were defined, and people tend to stick to the original framing. There's a distinction made between what are called mandatory versus discretionary access controls. Before I get into this, so I won't be here Monday and Tuesday. I will send out a reading assignment. I will be back. We will meet on Wednesday. This distinction between mandatory and discretionary access controls, what's it trying to be? So the idea is, a discretionary access control is one that can be disabled. Okay? So if the software is in a position to elect to apply or not apply a control, it's a discretionary control. Okay? Generally speaking, file permissions are considered discretionary controls because the party who owns the file in an access control system is able to change the permission. Mandatory controls, as originally framed, were controls that were imposed by the system is going to be the problem here, on the processes. So the processes have, you know, they're not participants in the policy here, right? It happens. If you don't like it, tough. Okay? So, one way to capture this distinction is that a discretionary policy is policy done by the process, okay, or with the process, but in collaboration with the process. Right? So this is, I'm trying to protect my files from you, so hopefully I'm going to set the permissions correctly. But it's not a systemic policy issue that I should be required to protect my files from you. Mandatory policy is policy done to the process. It's policy that the process has no control over, there's no discretionary aspect to this policy, thus mandatory. However, this is not the way this idea was originally framed. Okay? The way this idea was originally framed, it was assumed that mandatory policy had to be implemented by the kernel. And the reason this was assumed was all of the systems in which these ideas were explored early on were large monolithic systems. Okay? And there was a discussion at the time initiated by a whole bunch of people, but probably best captured by Anderson in the Anderson report, about how to construct something called a reference monitor. Now, what's a reference monitor? Well, a reference monitor is the thing that watches everything going on in the system and it enforces the mandatory policy. And it's assumed in that literature that the reference monitor must be the kernel. Because it's assumed that the things that you want to monitor are basically mostly in the system call path, and so the kernel is standing in the right position. And of course, if it's not in the kernel, in their view of the literature, it's presumptively not trusted. Now, what the people who did the write-up of this stuff failed to notice at the time, I mean, it took several years, is indeed there is other software in any secure system that's trusted. And the key issue here is not whether the reference monitor lies within the kernel, okay, but rather whether the reference monitor has the available primitives to enforce its policy. That is a kernel design issue, or at least it's a what's underneath the issue. And can it be circumvented? If I can bypass the reference monitor, it's not a reference monitor. Now, one interesting question you can ask is, so what exactly is the dividing line between these two? Is there something that we can point to that is sort of the essential feature that defines the dividing line between discretionary and mandatory control? If I'm looking at this from an engineering perspective, if I want to implement this, what do I need to have? Okay. And there is a... Some people think this is not a security policy. I'm going to claim it's a security policy. There is a policy that just exactly straddles this line. And the policy is called confinement. And the confinement policy, what's the confinement policy? A process is confined if it can only transmit information and authority over an authorized channel. So authorized would mean permitted by the policy. Confinement is a unidirectional policy. It does not control information flow in. It only controls information flow out. As originally framed by Butler Lampson, confinement covered both explicit flow of information, read and write operations, send operations, things like this, and covert channels. Right. Covert channel is things like I alter my paging behavior in a way that has systemic performance impact that you can measure, and I use changes in the system performance as a means to transmit bits to you. That's an example of a covert channel. There's actually a surprising amount of good open literature on covert channels, but to date, I'm not aware of a really cohesive treatment of them in the literature. There's a bunch of reason to think that the work that was done in the early 90s may need to be re-examined, which is part of why I'm not going to try to deal with them in this course, except in the very lightest way. So, why is this policy right on the boundary? Well, if you think about it, what we're saying is that if a system is confined, then there's the process inside a box. That information inbound to the process is okay, but in general, information outbound from the process is going to bounce. It's going to cause an error. It's not going to happen, something like this. Except that we're entitled to draw a small hole in the box where, by prior arrangement, outbound communication on an authorized channel is permitted. It turns out this is enough to let you implement mandatory controls. Here's how. The question is, who sets up the box? And who do the outbound channels go to? So one thing I can do if I have this structure is I can build a reference monitor. Not in the kernel, as an application. And that reference monitor can manage communication, allow or prohibit communication, across confined compartments. Now, what about the inward stuff? Well, it turns out the inward stuff is actually not terribly hard to control. What do I need to know to know that there's no inward communication? I need to know that nobody holds a descriptor to anything inside that box. Because if there's no descriptor, there's no communication. I'm going to allow an exception for the reference monitor. That's the party implementing the policy, and we presumptively trust it in this story. But it turns out there are lots of reasons that I need to know that there are no descriptors pointing into the box. For example, if I want to have information that's private, I need to know that my access to a page is not something that you also have. If I've got the page, I need to know that I have an exclusive relationship with this page. I can then allow you to share it, but at least initially it's got to be exclusive. If you can look over my shoulder at everything I put in this page, I've got no hope of keeping any information private. So if you start from a system in which you have confinement and a system in which when you initially acquire a resource, you have a guarantee about the exclusivity of your access to that resource, that's enough to build the reference monitor. Now we're then going to have the issue that the reference monitor has to be guarded from the rest of the system. If it's ultimately the thing in charge of the system, that's easy, but we can imagine doing several reference monitors, each of which does some different policy within its domain. And some of them might be policies that you might like, and some of them might be policies that you don't really care for. As long as they happen in different logical submachines, that is, as long as there's an isolation contract, that's still okay. And it turns out you can bootstrap this all the way up from the kernel or all the way down from the applications, depending on your point of view. It's been done. There is a reference design for how to do this. It turns out that reference design was one of the inputs into the definition of the TCSEC standard. And Sue Reginis, who did it, sat on the committee that designed the Orange Book. Curiously, a lot of the ideas for how to do this didn't make it into the Orange Book. It was known that this was feasible. If you go look at the standard, you'll find that the language makes it very hard to see that this would be an acceptable design. And the reason is that the standard activity was viewed as codification of existing practice and maybe a little bit of stretch. Right? They weren't trying to invent while they wrote the document. And usually in a standards process, that's a good thing. In this case, it was too early to do that, and we ended up with a standard that nobody could actually build for a long time. I am way off on my topic list, but since I was here, it was worth going through. I want to come back to message passing. So, we've talked about what happens at the register level and what happens at the string level. Or I've talked about it, you've listened politely and asked occasional questions. This doesn't really tell us much about what operations are in the system, what system calls the kernel supports, or even whether it supports system calls at all. Right? We've established, I think, that faults are going to come in, exceptions are going to come in, we're going to turn them into a message, and we're going to deliver it to somebody. And hopefully with a little more of the mechanism of messaging described, you can see that if the kernel needs to deliver a message, it's certainly in a position to put the relevant bits into the relevant process state and start the process. And as far as the process can tell, there's an incoming message. It happens to come from the kernel, but the process can't really see that unless the kernel explicitly does something to tell it. Okay. So, in a minimalist sense, there are two functions that a microkernel has to do. It's got to do exception encapsulation and interrupt encapsulation. Those are, for this purpose, the same. And it has to implement the communication mechanism. And if we really wanted to be purist, that would almost be it. Right? We're still going to have to worry about protecting memory maps. But we could just about get away with that in all of it. I'm going to argue that we shouldn't, but the L4 guys tried to. What about at the application level? So the pattern of a message is that we're going to do a send operation. By the way, from now on, every time I talk about doing a send or a receive operation, you should understand that this is being done as part of a send and wait operation. But the reason I'm going to talk about the send part usually is I'm trying to focus about half of the protocol at that particular moment. And somebody pointed out yesterday that I was missing something on the input side of the receive. I said the receiver says if data registers are coming in, what slots do they go into? Now, in actual fact, there's no need to specify that. And the sequence of evolution here was, look, in the early systems that transmitted registers, they only transmitted four registers. You got them, if you're only transmitting four, the right design from a performance standpoint is transmit all four registers unconditionally. You don't want to send? Save your registers, stick zeros. I don't want to receive? Save my registers, reload them. But don't put a conditional in the path to decide how many of the four registers to send. You're going to spend more time executing the branch instruction than you're going to spend copying the four registers. With the move to virtual registers, this design actually has to be revised some, and you do end up with a counter in there. And typically, the way the virtual registers are thought about is you now imagine, well, there's really just this array of virtual registers that we're going to implement in memory, but we're always going to think of them as behaviorally as though they were registers. And the first few of them we're not actually going to store in memory, we're going to store in the hardware. So when I send a message, right, I'm sending it to a destination with a payload, okay? And I'm going to get back a response. Well, no, send doesn't imply a response. So let me introduce an operation. We call it call. Or, no, let me not call it call. I'm going to
call it Sendwing.
Because I want to focus on the round trip.
Funny, we've seen the Sendwing thing before.
Now, so this is how we would write this in a sort of C procedure-ish kind of a style. But there's a rewrite of this, and it's a trivial rewrite, but it's sort of, sometimes it's revealing, which is to say, the other way to look at this is to put the destination first. Okay. And to say, well, I'm going to think of the destination as an object or an interface, and I'm going to send a message to that interface. And by the way, the response here was also a kind of a payload, right? It's the payload coming back in the other direction. One of the things I said yesterday is that in practical terms, it's not very useful to send a message. It's just bits without any meaning, right? We always send a message because we're trying to communicate something, and since there's more than one message in the world, it's always the case that somewhere in the message design there's a field that says, oh, this is a mumble fratz message, right? And the receiver says, oh, I know what to do with a mumble fratz message. Or perhaps it says, oh, I don't know what to do with a mumble fratz message, complain. Okay? But there's always something that identifies the type of the message. And I'm going to call that, depending on which day you ask me, request code or the operation code. And the truncation of operation code to opcode is not an accident. From the client perspective, you can actually view send and wait as the execution of an instruction. A rather long-running instruction that involves context switching. But from the user, from the application perspective, it's an instruction, which is not good. Similarly, in every message system in which there's a response, the first thing you want to know is this a good response or is it a not-so-good response? Okay. So there's always a response code. And this is not an attribute of, this is not a consequence of a kernel-imposed design. Right? It's sort of inherent in the idea of messaging, and messages need some kind of type system. It's a dynamic type system. Now, having said that, I'm going to unpack the payload one step. Okay, so I'm going to rewrite this object invocation, which is what I'm sneaking up on. Okay. And so now the notion is, so I'm going to send to a destination, which I'm going to name by a descriptor. And the reason this dest arrow notation is convenient is that descriptor kind of has some of the feel of a pointer, an object reference in Java. So instead of saying I'm just going to send a payload, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to admit that intrinsic in the idea of a payload, there seems to be this notion of request code that's sort of unavoidable. Okay, so what I'm going to send is a request code concatenated with some sort of a payload. Okay, this is not the same payload as over on the left, right? These two things, this payload over here on the left is this concatenation. Having done that, I'm now going to relabel this. So this payload, it's not really a generic payload. Okay. It's actually arguments to the request. There may be none. It may be an empty set. Now, This arguments part is not interpreted by the kernel. In fact, the request code is not interpreted by the kernel either. But there's a reason to do this rewrite. And sloppy notation. Right. Single arrow, I'm trying to evoke pointer. Double arrow, I'm trying to evoke response. And what's going to come back? Right, is going to be a similar kind of a payload, except that since it's the message going the other way, it's the result code concatenated with any return value that may come back from this operation. If anything comes back, we're allowed to do one-way operations. What the hell? Let's do one more rewrite. Request code is just a name. And if we simply take that name and just textually rewrite this to move it outside the parenthesis, all of a sudden this looks like a procedure call, and this ought to be starting to look real familiar. The result code has the property that there's always a result code that says this is an okay result. Now, why is that? Because pragmatically, when I send you a message of a given type, I know what the correct response looks like. There's no need for a type code there because the correct response to a given request usually has only one reply. Sometimes that reply will involve a union, but the union will already intrinsically have a tag. It's part of the reply. So in the result code case, the possibilities are it's okay or something unusual happened. And what that was unusual happened, which I'm going to call an exception code. Okay. So if we take that view, we can say, oh gosh, this is a procedure call, right, where I make a call with some arguments, and I either get back a return code or an exception gets thrown. Now, about that exception gets thrown part, remember at the kernel layer, this was just bits. And we actually would like this, in some cases, to be literal. If we have a language that supports exceptions, right, we're going to get the result code back, you know, somewhere very low in a library. We're actually going to look at that result code, and if that result code is non-zero, it might be a perfectly fine implementation to actually turn that into a language exception. And in languages that don't support exceptions, right, we may want to say, look, if something really bad happens, you know, there are a few cases where I'm prepared to deal with it, but there are a lot of cases where I'm not even going to check because there's nothing I can do about it. And what I want is I want to be whacked in the head when one of these things happen. I want to be killed. Right? In which case, it would be convenient, not essential, but it would save some code, if as part of the kernel transport, I could set a bit in the receive that said, look, if I get back an answer, I'm expecting a result. And if the result's not okay, don't even give me the answer. Finish the protocol, but immediately set an error. So just like I take a page fault, I'm going to take a bad result fault. This is a software-defined fault. Okay, but I'm going to treat it the same way I treat a divide-by-zero fault. I'm going to ship a message to some handler process that knows how to deal with my exceptions. And in this case, it might be the case that deals with my exceptions means the handler destroys me. Now, one last piece. What about this destination thing? What exactly, from the application perspective, Right? From the implementation perspective, we've said this destination is going to name some kind of an endpoint. And I didn't take a position on this yesterday, but I actually now believe provisionally that the best endpoint design is the one in which the endpoints are explicit. There are some interesting challenges hiding in that design that we're wrestling through at Coyotas and that the L4 folks are now struggling with. But if we can work through them, this seems like the cleanest design. But I want it to be the case that if I'm implementing a service, that there might be more than one protocol that this service knows how to speak. To give a really simple example, right, I might want to have some kind of protocol that has control operations on this service. And the second protocol, the clients of the service can use. And these protocols might be different. And particularly in the control versus client example, I might want to control, I might want to have some means of saying which of my callers are allowed to use which interface. Okay, so I just snuck a word in here that's actually very precisely the word I meant to use, but I want to make it real explicit about that. So it's not that I'm sending a message to a process. It's that I am sending a message on an interface that's named by a descriptor. Under the covers, that interface names an endpoint. And there is some service that implements that interface. So let me go back to the entry descriptor for a moment. So the thing is, I still need the destination, right? I still need to know what the process is that's going to serve this interface or what the endpoint is. So what we're going to do is we're going to modify the entry descriptor . So what's going to be in an entry descriptor is an endpoint, which depending on our design might turn out to be a process. And an interface identifier. Now this is weird. Why put the interface identifier here? Why not just have the caller provide the interface identifier? Anybody tell me?
Somehow the caller might be able to find the interface identifier of something it's not supposed to have the ability to get, whereas if it's in the descriptor, it's controlled.
So let's turn that around. We might want to have policy about which interfaces are invoked by which clients. And in order to do that, it must be the case that a client can't state an arbitrary interface that it should invoke. Right. So what we would kind of like is to have what Hermann Hartig has labeled, it's a very old idea, he's just the first person that came up with a decent label for it, protected payload. This is payload that the receiver receives, but the sender doesn't send, and therefore cannot forge. This is payload that comes from a protected source, protected in this case by the cone. Okay, so I'm going to have to now modify my story, because Once you introduce protected payload, what happens from the caller point of view is not quite symmetric with what happens from the service point of view. Okay? So the caller sends some payload. The receiver gets the payload plus the interface ID. That interface ID, how does that get transmitted? The kernel looks at the descriptor you invoke, plucks it out of the descriptor, and moves it as part of the messaging protocol. So it is disclosed to the receiver, but never disclosed to the sender. The sender can't alter it. Now it turns out if we do this, we've just done capabilities. This is the difference between descriptors and capabilities. Because part of naming an interface is, we've said, what's an interface? An interface is a set of operations you can do. What operations? Namely, the procedures that were defined as part of the interface. This is not entirely like a Java interface, because we can't define constants in it. It's not like a class. We can't define stateful members in this interface, right? It's a cross address space phenomenon, right? We're going to do a procedure call here. But within that constraint, what we've defined is a set of operations that the holder of this capability is permitted to invoke. That's permissions. That's all permissions bits are. You want to think about a read-only page versus a read-write page? You can think of those as two interface IDs that are implemented by the page object. Now, obviously, we're not going to go and soft emulate pages, but it's a conceptual way to put pages back into the design and make everything sort of consistent that actually turns out to be a very nice way to look at them. So on the receiver side, I'm going to get this unforgeable ID, and I'm going to get this request code. Assuming my recording survived, I'll make sure you get that as well. So now the request code is going to be interpreted in the context of an interface, right? So the request code is really the name of which procedure relative to the interface I'm invoking. And separate from that, I'm going to get told what interface that procedure was in. And on the receiver side, I'm going to recombine them. Conceptually, I'm going to recombine them. And I'm going to do a big switch statement. Okay, and the outer is actually limited to, the outer switch statement is going to say which interface got invoked, and the inner switch statement is going to say which method of that interface got invoked, and now I'm going to call the implementation. The implementation is going to come back and I'm going to send back a response. And curiously, it turns out if your capabilities have this kind of style of thing where they name a resource and an interface, right, you actually have enough to build a fully powerful protection model. There's some things it does well and some things it does arguably less well, but it's enough to build a fully expressive system. Catch is, so how am I going to distinguish this control and this client thing? Well, I'm going to build different entry capabilities with different interface IDs. So the deal is, if I'm the service, when I fabricate an entry capability to me, which is how the entry capabilities come into the world, part of fabricating them is to say what interface ID should go into this capability. And the way you get a capability to a service is it comes to you by a chain of messages. Ultimately, it started because the service fabricated that capability. And we're going to have to worry about how do these things propagate in the world to talk about security. And that's a little tricky, but it's not so tricky as people have wanted it to be in the literature. Okay, so this is, I didn't actually get as far as IDL, but just to close the loop on this, so now the question is going to be, well, how do I describe one of these interfaces? Because you and I have to agree on what the request codes are, or I don't know what your request means. Okay, and the answer is, we're going to use something called an interface definition language, and we're going to declare interfaces that look an awful lot like Java interfaces. The big difference between a Java interface and this stuff, aside from the fact that this is an operating system and that's language, is that in Java, if I have an interface pointer, I can use runtime type information to get back the implementing class. In this system, you can't. The interface is all there is. The existence of classes in Java is a bug in the design. Another difference is, in Java, what you have is implementation inheritance. A subclass can call a method in a superclass, and that's what inheritance was envisioned as being for in object languages. In this system, there is no implementation. It's interface. You can do interface inheritance, right? But that's inheritance of, we all agree we implement the following procedures, not we share the code behind those procedures. And I'll do more on that next Wednesday, and I'll hopefully start in the memory. Good.